We're looking at five words that describe the Anabaptist worldview. So far, we've considered brotherhood and devotion as two of the emphases of Anabaptism. We're ready for a third word, one of the S's, and that word is salmon. Just kidding. In order to introduce the S word, I want to talk about salmon. Why is it that salmon swim upstream? We know about this. We know how they will go against waterfalls and so on. In order to get back to the place they respond. Why? How is it that they know where to go? Because salmon, in the typical life of a salmon, they'll leave their freshwater birthplace, travel down mountain streams, come to the ocean, swim out into the ocean hundreds of miles from home, and then after a couple years, they begin the trek back. And how do they do it? According to John Webb, a biologist with the Atlantic Salmon Trust, he says that most salmon spawn within 5 miles of where they grew up. Now, scientists are still teasing out what all is going on here and how these fish are able to make that trek home, how they're able to find home after all of that distance and all of that time. And one of the answers, it does seem like that there is some kind of a magnetic, almost like a GPS in a salmon that is able to orient toward where it came from. But another factor that scientists are rather certain plays a role here is what they call the home odors. That is, where a specific fish was spawned has a particular smell. And that smell is embodied in molecules, of course, very, very small. And those molecules just spread out from the home place, and they go far. I remember hearing a preacher years ago, I think I was maybe 10, and I'd never heard a preacher talking about some science stuff that I'd remembered, and so I was just captivated. And this preacher came from the West Coast, and he talked about how that if you would take a bottle of dye out on the West Coast, dump it into the ocean, and if that bottle would be mixed in into all the oceans, Atlantic, Indian, Pacific, and so on, where it was evenly distributed, you could come here to the East Coast and take a jar, fill it up with water, and you'd have a couple molecules from that original bottle of dye. Well, I remembered that years later when I was teaching chemistry and decided to make that a project, a little research project for the students to do the math and to see if this preacher was right or not. And we found out he wasn't. That it wasn't just a couple molecules from that original bottle of dye that would be present in the jar. There were actually over 1,000, according to our calculations. So that's what happens here with the home odor. You have these molecules of home odor that get distributed further and further from the home. And so one of the things it seems like salmon may be able to do is to pick up those molecules that are present, even out there where they are, and turn in the direction of where the molecules are a little more concentrated and go to where they're a little more concentrated, and that guides them back home. So for a salmon, they're not just oriented to go upstream, you know, just some kind of death wish that if the stream's going this way, I'm going to go the other. The salmon has a positive vision. I want to go home. And that vision, That home odor, that vision of home is what is driving him to go that direction, even though it happens to be a very difficult path and one that is in the or in a direction that the other forces are going differently. Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton said something like this: a dead thing can go with the stream, but only a living thing can go against it. And the salmon are going against it because they're alive and because they're motivated and energized and called by this home odor. I find this to be a compelling picture of the gospel. For the believer, Jesus Christ, knowing him, following him, loving him, obeying him is our home odor. That's the positive, compelling vision for our lives. It gives direction. Early Anabaptism had a specific name for this vision of Christ as what it is we are aiming toward, that we are following. And they called it, and I'm not German enough to be able to pronounce these words correctly, but Nachfolge Christi, following Jesus. That's the call. That's our home odor. That's the positive, compelling vision for us. Nachfolge Christi describes the gospel in terms of following him. It reads the Bible through the lens of the teachings and life of Christ. It understands that the goal of life is to love him and to become like him. So, Christ-centered, Nachfolge Christi, are these the emphases? Well, neither of them begin with an S, and so clearly I've chosen another word. Although I'd be happy with either of these, Christ-centered, Nachfolge Christi. But I've chosen another word for a number of reasons. See, why not just say this is an emphasis of Anabaptism? Because I think it is. Well, I've chosen another word because, according to one Gallup poll, 84% of Americans believe Jesus is God. In other words, 84% of Americans are giving some kind of credence to the idea that we ought to be, that Christ is ultimately important. If Jesus is God, then he's of ultimate importance. 66% of Americans claim to be committed to Jesus Christ. So this term, Christ-centered, it's a great phrase, a good term. It's an important one. It captures something really significant. But I'd like a term that describes maybe how our understanding of being Christ-centered is something is different than this. According to Ron Sider in The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, he says that evangelical Christians are as likely to embrace lifestyles every bit as hedonistic, materialistic, self-centered, and sexually immoral as the world in general. He says that divorce is more common among born-again Christians than in the general American population. By the way, Ron Sider is a professor at Eastern College, close to Philadelphia. He says that only 6% of evangelicals tithe. Now, that's not only that evangelicals only tithe 6%. It's that only 6 out of every 100 evangelicals are giving, are tithing. He says that white evangelicals are the most likely people to object to neighbors of another race. That sexual promiscuity of evangelical youth is only a little less outrageous than that of their non-evangelical peers. That fully 26% of traditional evangelicals do not think premarital sex is wrong. That the percentage of Christian men involved in pornography is not much different than that of the unsaved. That born-again Christians spend 7 times more hours each week in front of their televisions than they spend in Bible reading, prayer, and worship. He concludes his book by saying that every day the church is becoming more like the world it allegedly seeks to change. Ron Sider is making the case that whatever we mean by Christ-centered, it doesn't mean to be that it doesn't mean that it's going to be really anything functionally different than general society. He goes on to say that the cultural captivity of Christianity in the West is nearly complete. So, is the Anabaptist emphasis on Christ any different than this? Historically, when Anabaptism is talked about being Christ-centered, what is meant by that? So I'm looking for another word that captures that emphasis, and I'm returning here to this analogy of the salmon. It's the home odor that causes the salmon to swim against the tide, the flow, to jump waterfalls, to refuse to give in to the currents that are so powerfully headed in one direction. We've used the image of tsunami to talk about the powerful currents that are in play today in our lives. Does following Jesus, does that have anything to do with whether we will or will not be swept up in those currents? I'm suggesting that the Anabaptist emphasis on following Christ, our home odor, will of necessity take us in a direction opposite to that of the prevailing culture, what we called in the first night the spirit of the age. Following Christ will be countercultural. Just like the salmon who's following that home odor, following Christ will take us against the dominant flow of society today. Now, this is another first and second. Following Jesus, countercultural. Following Jesus is that's the focus, that's the direction. But that will of necessity mean that we're going to be different than general society. So what is a word that captures both of those? Both an emphasis on Christ as our focus and as our vision, and a realization that following Him will put us at odds with dominant culture. And for that word, I've gone back into our history, but also back further than that, into the Scriptures, 2 Corinthians 6:17. Therefore, go out from their midst and be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch no unclean thing, and then I will welcome you. Or we could talk from Matthew 7:14, the gate is narrow, the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Anabaptists emphasize separation. Now, I chose this word because it captures both the first and second. Separation, first of all, is separation to Christ. I know this is a word that maybe carries some baggage for us as a people. It's a word that sometimes has been reduced to merely dressing differently, but it's a much bigger word than that. And it's first of all a word that says, oh, our focus is on Christ. We're separated to Him. This is why John C. Wanger, when he wrote a book on this topic, that was how he entitled it, Separated Unto Christ. This word includes both separation to Christ as well as separation from evil. Following Christ will put us out of sync with the dominant culture. Anabaptism emphasizes that conformity to Jesus will be evidenced by a distinctiveness from those who are not following Christ. Saying yes to Jesus means saying no to all other lords. And I would suggest that in light of contemporary Christianity, it seems that it's really vital for us to not only keep first things first, but also to keep second things. Not only separated to Christ, but to realize that separation is going to call us to be separate from the evil in the world as well. So it's not one or the other, it's both. It seems in some ways that contemporary Western Christianity, and by no means all of it, but that in some ways it's tried to keep first things, this Christ-centeredness, without needing to keep second things. Rob Dreher said this, "If today's churches are to survive the new dark age, they must stop being normal." But normal is another word, way to say that to stop being normal means we're going to have to stop just going the direction of dominant culture. We will need to commit ourselves more deeply to our faith, and we will need to do that in ways that seem odd to contemporary eyes. That's separation to Christ, separation to evil. This is not being different for difference's sake. It's being different for God's sake. In 1 John 2, 3 to 6, we read, "And by this we know that we've come to follow Him. We've come for Him to be our home odor if we keep His commandments. Whoever says, 'I know I'm following Jesus,' but does not keep His commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. Whoever keeps His word, in him truly the love of God is perfected. By this we may know that we're in Him. Whoever says he abides in Him ought to walk in the same way that He walked." A focus on Jesus will cause us to walk in ways that are at odds with general society. Now, Anabaptism does not say that separation is removing ourselves from the presence of other people. Jesus made it abundantly clear. He's not calling us out of the world. But it is a separation from the direction that the world is going. Keep them from the evil in the world, Jesus said. What picture captures something of this emphasis of following Christ is going to put you at odds? This impulse that's at the heart of the Anabaptist vision. You see, we expect to be different. We understand that as followers of Christ, we're pilgrims and strangers rather than the moral majority. What picture helps us to envision that impulse? And I've chosen the picture of a martyr. From its beginning, Anabaptism has understood that following Christ is going to take us in different directions, and that different direction might even include death. Now, this is the most dramatic implication of following Christ, perhaps. But that same impulse that said we're willing to follow Christ, even if it means we die, is seen in other significant ways throughout our history. This willingness to die for Christ has also made us willing to take ethical positions that have been out of sync with many other people in our world, including some Christian people. 500 years ago, it was the insistence that the church and the government should be separated. 150 years ago, it was the avoidance of slavery and being involved with that. Today, it includes an insistence on loving even our enemies and not participating in war. Anabaptists emphasize separation to Christ, and our early history of martyrdom attests to, speaks of that emphasis. What about practices? Why are Mennonites so okay in general with being different from everyone else? And I know there's exceptions to this. And for some of us, the oddness of being an Anabaptist can be a real struggle. But what do we do? What have we done that has nurtured this expectation that following Jesus will put us at odds with the dominant culture? Because I do think it's among us. We have that general sense. What are the practices that have nurtured that? I want to mention two. A practice that plants a countercultural mindset in us is the prayer veiling. Along with, and please hear me here, along with men identifying with our women. Since few women today veil their hair, Mennonite women stick out. And we feel that difference. In the home that I grew up in, our family went to a lot of places together. And I saw my dad and my brothers identifying with mom and my sister Phyllis, identifying with them without shame or without embarrassment. And I think from that I unconsciously accepted that obedience to Christ is going to make us different in some ways, and that's okay, and it's good. And willingness to be different in smaller things nurtures this capacity to swim against the moral currents of this age. A second practice is that of church discipline. And by church discipline, and I know this is another word that can carry a lot of baggage. By church discipline, I mean the measures a congregation takes to confront and correct sin in the life of a follower of Jesus. Church discipline is a practice that is seldom observed in churches today. And I want to quote here from a Southern Baptist, Albert Moeller, on the subject of church discipline. He says, "The decline of church discipline is perhaps the most visible failure of the contemporary church. No longer concerned with maintaining purity of confession or lifestyle, the contemporary church sees itself as a voluntary association of autonomous members." And we talked about that in our first session. Basically, he's saying the Christian people today see the church as just something that you come together as individuals to hopefully get something that's going to help you with your connection with Christ. It's not about the body itself. It's not about the church itself. He says, the contemporary church sees itself as a voluntary association of autonomous members with minimal moral accountability to God, first of all, and much less to each other. In other words, there's little actual submission called for on the part of each other. A local church in my area will preach on Sunday morning that sexual relations outside of marriage is sin, but ignores the well-known cases of that in the members that are sitting in the pew. For conservative Anabaptism, this ancient practice, this is a practice that really was part of the church for many, many years. As Moeller is saying, it's a recent development for church discipline not to be a part of the practice. But for many conservative Anabaptist churches, this continues to be a practice where brotherhood covenants are made, reviewed, and expected to be followed. And if someone consistently violates our agreement, they're confronted. It's not unusual in our circles for someone to acknowledge places where they're living outside of the brotherhood agreement and to ask for forgiveness. This practice of church discipline continues to nurture the understanding that following Christ means real separation from the world. We're going to live differently. A powerful story from Scripture. You recall with me how Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, or better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we know a lot of their story, and I just want to pick up the one that we find in Daniel chapter 3. But before that, I read for them chapter 1, verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Daniel understood that his commitment to God meant that he was going to live his life differently than the people around him that weren't following God. And that was even in things like his eating habits and in his spiritual disciplines. And of course, that got him thrown into the lion's den. His three friends understood what we've been talking about as well. We pick up the story here in chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, this image was probably an obelisk. They would often carve these out of one piece of stone. The dimensions given here would be a 90 foot by 9 foot. So 9 foot wide and 90 foot high. That's a 10 to 1 ratio, the same ratio that's used in the Washington Monument. Of course, the Washington Monument is significantly higher. We continue reading, and it says, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you're to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." It was specifically mandated by Nebuchadnezzar that the leaders come to what is thought to be, this is thought to be a dedication ceremony. Some think that this was a test of loyalty that was going on here. The king may have had some indication that his rule was being threatened by other people. And so he was going to make sure who is with me and who's not. And that's one of the reasons that these three Hebrew men were called, because they were in leadership. So they're part of this large group. The three Hebrew men have declared themselves as being primarily loyal to God. The pressure to conform here, as they go out to where this statue, this image, this obelisk has been set up, and while everyone is bowing down, the pressure for them to just do what everybody is doing, go with the flow, join the stream, must have been extreme. The only thing that would empower a countercultural stand for these three men would be a clear home odor, a goal that merited dying for. Now, I don't know what this would have been like. I really don't. Some time ago, my wife and I tasted maybe just a similar kind of pressure to a small extent. We were present for a program that it seemed like most of the people in the audience, this was not a Christian program necessarily, but it seemed like most of the people in the audience were professing Christians. That was just kind of the feel, and they were older people, very conservative group. But the program was not a spiritual program. But toward the end, they played a song. And this song was a mixture of Christianity and praise of the military and pride in being American and how great and powerful and strong America is and America's military is. And when they started singing and playing this particular song, we felt like we were at a revival meeting or something, because I mean spontaneously the entire audience minus two rose to its feet, and it really felt like worship and praise for the American dream. That was just what that was all of the aura and the feel. And we couldn't embrace that. But we felt it was hard to sit there in our seats. And it would have been a lot harder to be the only one standing when everyone else was seated. Like I said, just a small little glimpse, perhaps, in the pressure that these men would have felt. But they stood firm. They did not bow to this image. And then when they were called into question, their response was, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up." The king gave them a chance and said, "You don't have to die here. I'm going to give you another chance. Go out there, and this time I want to see you bow down." The pressure is ramped up. But they said, "Don't even give us the chance. We know what we're going to do. Our focus is fixed. We're following God. And following God means that we're not going to bow to this idol. So let's just deal with it now. Go ahead and put us into the fiery furnace." We know the story. We know how, in this case, God rewarded their faithfulness by delivering them from death. In the case of the martyrs, he rewarded their faithfulness by giving them grace to die. To die courageously, and then by receiving them to himself. In both situations, the Hebrew boys, the martyrs, in both situations, the response to those looking on and observing is something like that of Nebuchadnezzar's. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God." Anabaptists emphasize separation. Anabaptism is a Christian tradition that has understood the radical, countercultural, upstream, swimming, salmon-like nature of being a disciple of Christ. Historically, we've used the word nonconformity to describe this impulse. But perhaps that word has become too narrow. to accurately describe this fundamental emphasis of Anabaptism. Nonconformity captures the negative side of the call, perhaps the second thing. It is vital, it is absolutely vital that you and I cultivate the ability to talk about, in compelling ways, the more central positive vision, Nachfolge Christi. If all we can say is that we dress differently or we don't go to war, our young people are going to find it difficult to get on board. And the older ones of us will have a form of Christianity without the passion that characterized our forefathers. 3 words that talk about Anabaptist emphases: brotherhood, separation, devotion. Anabaptists emphasize these. They emphasize separation, which is another way to say Christ-focused and countercultural.